Welcome to the Knife Junkie Podcast, your weekly dose of knife news and information about knives and knife collecting. Here's your host, Bob the Knife Junkie DeMarco.
Welcome to the Knife Junkie Podcast. I'm Bob DeMarco. On this edition of the show, I'm speaking with custom knife maker Dave Ridbaum of Kingdom Armory. Now, I remember the exact day I discovered Kingdom Armory for myself. It was the day my second daughter was born, 7 years ago. I sat in the hospital room hours before go time and was mindlessly scrolling through Instagram. And the only thing I look at on Instagram are knives. And I came across Kingdom Armory. It was the Samaritan. That was the first knife. An upswept flip point blade. That was the first one I noticed, with an intricately executed bolster and handle. And then came Bill the Butcher, a folding cleaver that looked both vintage and futuristic at the same time. I fell in love with Dave's cool, sleek, yet adorned style, as well as the lines and profile of his work. So you can imagine how thrilled I was to see him collaborating with Spyderco on his most iconic design, making it within reach for the hoi polloi, such as myself. I look forward to talking with Dave about his 14-year trip through knife making to reach this place. But first, be sure to like, comment, subscribe, hit the notification bell, and download us wherever you listen to podcasts. And if you want to join us on Patreon, where you can get all sorts of extra knife content and perks, be sure to check us out. Just go to theknifejunkie.com/Patreon. That's the quickest way. Again, it's theknifejunkie.com/Patreon.
The Get Upside app is your way to get cash back on your gas purchases. Get Upside is an app you put on your smartphone, and whenever you need to get gas, search your area for savings, claim your discount, fill up your tank, and then take a picture of the receipt with your phone. And that's it. You've just got cash back. Visit theknifejunkie.com/save on gas to get the app and start saving. Again, that's theknifejunkie.com/save on gas.
Dave, welcome to the show. How you doing?
Hey, Bob. Good. How are you doing?
I'm doing great. Hey, it's my pleasure. I want to, right up front, congratulate you on your Spyderco collaboration, the stovepipe.
Yeah, thank you.
It seems from reading some of the stuff on your website that this was a project in the works for quite some time. How did this all come about?
It's been about a 12-year road. Your intro mentioned the Samaritan and the Bill the Butcher. The Samaritan was my first folding knife design shortly thereafter, about 2010, I think it was. I started doing what has become known as Bill the Butcher. I was a Gangs of New York fan. You know, it was a kind of a cleaver-esque style folder. Realistically, it's kind of a one cliff with a nose. That's a good example there of the way the grind shows. Like, if you just deleted that upper swedge, you've got like a one cliff. But, that knife really took off in popularity. And in, I guess actually it was the very end of 2009, one of my customers posted photos of the prototype that I had done on the Spyderco forum. And, Sal, the owner, one of the founders of Spyderco, saw it, commented on it, was interested, and that is what initially introduced Spyderco to, I think, me and my company at that time, but at the very least, that design. Sal asked at that time that I keep him posted how the design went, how it evolved, and what the popularity was, and I just got busy making stuff, and I didn't follow back up with them until many years later. When Eric's taken the show over and circled back around, what was that? That was 2017. I think 2017, I built them an actual, prototype that they took out on the tour and showed at shows and wanted to get customers' feedback and whatnot. They had four or five different designs they took with them of mine that I did. And the Bill the Butcher was the one they wanted to go with. And it was 4.5 years from that point when we inked the deal to actually having product to customers, which is out now. And, the knife that they've produced is, for all intents and purposes, in quality, size, thickness, materials and whatnot, it is a custom that I just did not make. I mean, they've duplicated the exact knife I gave them. They just reverse engineered it and built what I gave them exactly the way I gave it to them, and that is the stovepipe. The only thing they've changed, of course, is the name, which is a reference to the hat.
Oh, the stovepipe hat, the Build-A-Butcher.
The stovepipe Build-A-Butcher hat. Yeah, there was, you know, that was a difficult thing figuring out what to name it. You know, there's, you know, people's proclivities might not appreciate the Build-A-Butcher as either the historical character William Poole or, you know, aggressiveness of the name or whatnot. I just, it's, you know, I liked it and it's, my customers like it, but it's now known as the Spyderco Stovepipe. So
it's funny. I was wondering, I'm like, how did he get from Bill the Butcher to Stovepipe? There has to be, and I didn't think of the hat, but that makes total sense because it's such an emblematic part of his look. So, I mean, you were in a very privileged spot, or a great spot through all your hard work and your great design eye that Spyderco knew. We're not sure what it is, but we want to work with this guy. So they took a bunch of your prototype. Now, at this time, had you already licensed the circle from them?
Yes, I had.
Okay. Okay. This is something that I think is so gangster on their part, is that for all intents and purposes, they have a patent on the circular hole in a blade. Yeah. And I think that's amazing. That's amazing.
Well, it's a tip of your hat to the OGs, right? Like, it's paying tribute to Spyderco. They, you know, sell license, trademark that at first, and then the trademark is expired, of course, but it's still, I should say patent. The patent expired. It's still trademarked. And, as such, I license it. Lots of other custom knife makers license it. Because why wouldn't you?
Yeah.
You know, right. it's not very expensive, and it gives you the ability to, hitch your wagon to Spyderco. And I have always liked them as a company. I carried their knives since I was a kid, you know, giving them out as wedding gifts over the years. It's just, you know, I would go way back. So I was really excited to get the opportunity to work with the guys at Spyderco and, you know, have my first big company that trusted me with my design go forward be Spyderco. It's a blessing, and I'm honored to do it.
On your, one of your web pages on your website, at the bottom, you have the quote, "Make it your ambition to lead a quiet life and attend to your own business and work with your hands." And it's Thessalonians. Yeah. Why do you have that on there?
I don't know. Do you have Kleenexes? My story in life and journey into this trade is, you know, one filled with pitfalls and tribulations and personal tragedies and heartbreak. And I found, and have always found, peace and quiet in working with my hands. And I guess the easiest way to explain it is this gig, this process started as a way for me to find therapy and struggling with all sorts of things in life. You know, addressing PTSD and death, divorce, suicide. I mean, our family's been through a hell of a roller coaster, and working with my hands is where I've gone to settle my spirit, my mind, and try and figure out how to make it through this wild ride that we're all in, you know, because none of us get out alive. So I just, that's something that I've been drawn to. You know, I didn't rely on drugs or alcohol. I relied on building stuff with the mindset that, you know, we're just all temporary. And if I can make something that stays behind, that my kids remember me, that pass on to their grandkids and their grandkids, or, you know, you end up with a knife and pass it through your family. You know, this eventually will go, I will end, this will cease to exist, but what I've built will be out in the world. And 150 years from now, much like the vintage axes that I've gotten interested in, somebody will pick that up and want to learn about the dude that made it 150 years ago. And why did he do it? Why did he do it like that? You know, and I have to, my responsibility is to make whatever that product is well enough that it lasts through the eons of time, so it becomes an heirloom. And that's why, you know, I view myself making things as a generational craftsman. I'm making a generational product. I don't want to make an iPhone that's outdated in 6 months and throw in the garbage. And that's not my gig. You know, I want to make stuff that lasts and gets reused, repurposed. You know, that's what I've been interested in.
It's there's a difference between leaving behind, say, a painting or a drawing, which I also have massive, you know, respect for, and the materials those are made out of are temporary. It's risky if you want to mark your life through the creative process, and you want your voice to be heard through the generations. It's kind of risky to make a painting or a drawing, because unless it's really, really kept, you know, not just through you, but through other people, in pristine condition, it's going to dissolve away. But as you mentioned in one of the videos I was watching about you, like you just said, in 150 years, some kid in France could pull this thing out of his drawer and be like, I don't know, like all of the ways it got to me, but I love that it got to me. And I have, you know, a big knife collection, and many of the things on my wall and in my collection are like that. But they have history. I don't know what the history is, but they have history.
Yeah. But you're interested in them, and your interest is what makes you want to explore and learn more about that. But for something to be interesting to you, it also has to be like, you know, we're visual animals. So this comes back to design, and this totally meshes with art, you know, painting or whatnot. You want to make something that's visually striking, so it's attention grabbing. And the Bill Butcher is a perfect example of that. I'm not surprised Spyderco picked that as the first one, but it's a design that is attention grabbing, which was intentional. It was kind of, view it like an art project, you know, love it, hate it. I've got paintings on the wall behind me, and I have them hanging because I like them, but somebody else might not like them. But the people that painted them didn't paint them for you to ignore, you know, the exercise in being an artist of any sort is to grab attention and to get it, your piece, whatever you build and craft, to be memorable and striking. So I'm just trying to also bring in the arts and crafts vibe of making it useful and long lasting.
Yeah. When you say arts and crafts vibe, are you talking like mid-century modern? Because now that you mention it, the handles have that.
Well, totally. That. So before I got into this gig, I was a home builder. And, you know, so I built custom homes and developed real estate and burned out. You know, I wanted something that I could do quietly without, you know, a million people with all their fingers in different things. And, you know, being a contractor at that level is kind of like being a professional babysitter of adults that don't get along. You know, the drywaller doesn't like the framer, the framer doesn't like the painter and the trim carpenters, and everyone hates the guy that pumps out the porta potty, but every person on the site relies on that guy. So it's, it's one of those things. But yeah, to your point, the arts and craft deal, which, American Arts and Crafts was like 1896 to 1919 effectively, with Stickley Green and Green. I'm sitting in a Stickley chair. I don't know if you can see it.
Yeah.
Anyway. Yeah. Yeah, and then that kind of ran its course, and then morphed into inspired Frank Lloyd Wright with the prairie style, and then that moved into modernism, which became post, kind of mid-century modern, which you're referring to. But each one of those, you know, and arts and crafts was originally inspired by Japanese design, you know, temples. So, all of these things through history, and that's what I love how everything in the world and history really in timelines can mesh together at some point. So I pull inspiration from my history and building, things that I see in nature, which goes back to the arts and crafts movement. That was very much about being inspired by nature and trying to tie your architecture and your building to the landscape and building things that were simple and purpose driven and useful. You know, one of the other things that I do is I work with ceramics and throw clay. That also pulls into arts and crafts. That was one of, you know, the homes were usually decorated sparsely. They didn't look like this with tchotchkes and curios all over the place. You know, it was stonework, woodwork, and ceramics. So
somewhat austere, but also beautiful.
Purpose driven.
So it's funny. Well, you mentioned simple and purpose driven, and we're kind of still talking about Bill the Butcher. And when Bill the Butcher came out, or I should say, when I became aware of it, it was also at a time when Warncliffe and straight edge blades as great tools and EDC knives were surfacing. You said about 2009 mm-hmm. or something like that. Is that
exactly?
When?
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. So I mean, I remember, and just looking back, it's a very appealing and compelling design, but it was also, whether or not you intended it to be, it was also talking to the trend that was happening in blade shape at the time.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't know if that was coincidental, incidental, or otherwise when, and Spyderco made note of this in their little write up that goes with each one of the stovepipes, but when I actually started in 2004, and it was 2007 when I made my first, like sole authored fixed blade. And when I decided that I was going to become a full-time custom knife maker, I sold my entire knife collection, honestly, to buy equipment. And then I canceled all my knife subscriptions and stopped going to shows, essentially. I have a weird purist sort of, I didn't want to be adulterated or influenced by other people's designs or follow a trend. I just wanted to do what I wanted to do. And I think by that point I had absorbed so much being immersed in knives my whole life. It's something I collected since I was a kid, of course. And all the years that I spent from 2004 to 2007 really actively working for people, I started, pimping knives on the Usual Suspects network. That's where this whole gig kind of started. And it was a, you know, hobby weekend gig, making handles and scales for people. And then it blew up and it took off from there. But, yeah, was I following a trend? I don't know. I could have been accidentally.
Oh, no, no. I'm not even suggesting you're following it. I'm suggesting, that maybe at the same time, like how pyramids popped up all around the world at the same time by cultures that didn't touch one another.
Sure, sure.
It's kind of the same thing. Yeah. You know,
well, it's a really useful, hugely useful blade shape. You know, you've got a straight edge. It's hard to keep it straight as you sharpen it, which many people have found out. You always end up with a little bit of whoop, but, you know, just the geometry and the physics of how that blade goes. If you have a lot of cutting thrust forced into that first part of a knife, the forward edge of that on the straight edge, you know?
Yeah.
But, you know, every knife has a different purpose. I kind of got into big sweeping bellies because they looked cool, but they also, on that arc and that radius, you get more cutting edge, of course, packed into a shorter blade shape. So, what I was using knives for at the time was a lot of game processing and skinning and that sort of thing. I was hunting a lot at the time, and my first knife was a skinner, which became a design I called the Blackthorn, and then that worked into the Samaritan. It's kind of, well, I got it sitting right here. Ooh, you can see. So that's the first knife I ever made.
Wow, that's the first one ever.
That was the very first knife I ever made, and it was in 2007. And now, I had been working on knives for 4 years or 3 years leading up to that, so I was totally steeped in what I liked and what I was looking for. But that was the first thing I sat down to do and did it and felt like, oh, that's pretty good. And if I want to make a go at this, I want someone's opinion. So I shipped it down to Triple Ott Design down in San Francisco. And Jason Santucci, who was running a custom knife gig and is still there, called me on the phone because I threw my business card in with it. And we had a quick conversation, and he contracted me off of this knife to start making knives for Tad Gear. And I was quite embarrassed and talked all around and around, because I didn't want to admit that I had only been making knives for about 2 weeks when that happened. So,
hey, you know, sometimes it's that kind of risk in life that mm-hmm. Makes all the difference. Yeah, sure, I can do that.
Yeah, well, it's, I don't know. And if anyone is wanting to get into this game and start really anything on their own in life, I would encourage you to be willing to fail. Because, like you said, you know, risk, taking any kind of risk, subjects you to the risk of failure, of course, but failure is going to be your most memorable teacher, you know. It's kind of why bad news sells. The media knows that well, right? But it's, as you know, human beings, that is something that sticks in your mind. You know, don't stick your hand in boiling water. It's hot. You only do it once and you remember that. If you go out to do something and you fail at it, you're going to inherently learn a lesson that you were going to remember. And if you have enough patience to stick with it through that failure, you're going to know, you know, like Thomas Edison said, you know, how many millions of ways did he try and make a light bulb? It only needed to figure it out once, right?
Right.
So.
Yeah, and that's how we all, I mean, I'm, you know, as I get older, I see how much I've learned through, I mean, really going through periods of time where I sucked at my job, and I knew it at the time. I was like, why am I bad at this? Like, So that first knife that you were just holding up, when you made that, had you made a decision? Well, tell me how it all started. Did you sell your whole knife collection, get all the equipment, and then start, or did you kind of slowly creep into it?
I guess my creeping process was through the knife modification game, the pimping, you know? Like I mentioned. And I started doing that when my first son was born. And I had a lot of time at home, as you're familiar with having kids where they're napping for hours and you're in the garage walking around pulling your hair, you're feeling crazy. So, I started tearing knives that I had apart because I had an interest in doing that. And then I had friends bring their knives over and that became projects. And then I had a buddy that said, hey, you know, you need to check into some of these online forums and maybe it'd be a weekend gig and make some extra cash, which is what it was for a while. And it was just something that I was doing. And then I was working through all the weekends. And at the time I was building homes and then doing the knife gig on the weekends, in about 2006, you know, the housing market started floundering and my life went sideways and my dad was still alive at the time. And he said, you know, you've gotten, I think, pretty good at the knife thing. Why don't you just give it a go? Why don't you just jump in? And my dad was famous for saying, you never know unless you try. It was a constant, like, encouragement to my life, and everyone who met him was just do it. Just go for it. Like, don't be afraid of running into that wall and keep doing it till you either get through the wall or figure out how to climb over it. You know, like, it's just that willingness to fail and studying, or either stupid or stubborn, you know, stubborn enough to keep hammering at it. And, so when I decided to make that switch was after a lunch with him and said, I'm just going to do that. So I went home, I pulled all my knives out. I was collecting Anzo and Strider and Siebert at the time. And, I had a couple of Jeremy Marsh's prototypes that I picked up from him at shows, and all that stuff had gone up in value. And I just dumped it all and bought my first grinder and a bunch of materials and belts, and, it arrived. I bolted the thing to the floor and, grabbed a piece of steel and started grinding and promptly threw it into, but my feet were in flip flops. Don't ever grind in flip flops. I have the scars for it. And that's how it started. And I picked it back up and kept going. I just, you know, I was, maybe I was too far in to give up, like right out of the starting blocks, but.
Well, one of the reasons I asked you about the Thessalonian quote up front is, that when I see pictures, I've seen pictures over the years of you in your shop, and then, you know, just in that really nice movie on Vimeo of a project I want to talk to you about in a second. Your process seems very insular. It seems like akin to a studio artist. Kind of you're in a beautifully well-lit space. You've got a gorgeous vista outside you can sometimes see, and it just looks like a very solitary and well, therapeutic, and you already told me that process. When it comes to grinding, you are very forthright that you freehand grind. Do you think that there is something in the act of freehand grinding and that sort of being in the moment, that if you is there something to that that adds to that therapeutic aspect?
I think so, because to do that, it's one of these like Macklemore things, you know, like you got to do something 10,000 hours before you really get good at it. Grinding is very much like that. It's, I don't know, I guess you could call it an art form. It's getting a feel for it. And, a lot of times, you got to be kind of in a zone. Sure, you can do it with jigs. You can do it with fixtures. You can figure out how to do it on platens and that sort of stuff. I grind sitting down, and the only work rest I have is my body, you know, and the mechanics that I use that works for me. And not everyone does it like that, but it's how I learned to do it. And I am physically feeling the metal with my hands. You know, I have, you get burnt, you get cut. There's an example right there. You bleed a lot, but I'm literally need to feel what I'm doing. I do very little, computer controlled anything. I don't do CAD hardly at all unless I'm running a water jet at my buddy's shop. Most of this is just like picking up a brush and going for it, or a lump of clay and moving it around until you get it to do what you want it to do. It's all raw materials for me. It's sheet steel, plate, raw goods. Most of my prototyping process is just, it just happens. I just feel it, live it. I have a brain where I think that I can see mechanical stuff working in my head, you know, the different turning it around, like kind of like a John Browning sort of thing. You know, that dude didn't draw anything in CAD and somehow he could figure out how to make a 1911 and it just came out of his hands on a bench. He didn't really know how to explain that to anybody, and I don't know how to explain it to you. Yeah. This is much more simple than, you know, the mechanics of a 1911, but I'll see it in my head and then sit down and just start fiddle farting around until I get it to work.
Well, is that how you went from making fixed blades to making folders? It was just like, I can do this, let me just figure it out.
Yep. And at that point, I, of course, because most of the knives that people sent in at that time to have work done were folders, I had taken apart thousands of them. Right. You know, so I was ahead of the learning curve just because I had taken apart so many things. You know, as a kid, I took apart everything. I didn't always get it back together. My grandmother hated me because her rotary phones didn't work. I could never get that back together in the radios, right? But you got to break stuff before you learn how to make stuff, is what I would tell anyone. You know, not, don't be afraid to break it, because fixing things is oftentimes how you'll learn to create, or it throws you down a path where a new interesting design comes into being because you're fixing something. You know, being a craftsman is learning really how to fix and mitigate any small mistake that you might make, because you're human.
Yes. We talk about that a bit on this show and on the live show we do is, and I'm always telling my girls about this too. Being an artist or creating art or doing anything creative, but especially that, it's problem solving to a great extent.
Absolutely.
Yes. There is style. You will develop style in how you solve problems. That's pretty much. And you will have, content and ideas that you want to express. But ultimately it's figuring out how to actually get it out. And that's a whole bunch of problems, that ultimately shape what that thing looks like.
Yeah.
Now you're talking about, you're kind of saying, you just kind of go for it and approach the steel and it kind of speaks to you. But at the same time, you have very specific models. Is your design process not necessarily even drawn on paper? Did you come up with Bill the Butcher and the Samaritan by just kind of going for it and something felt right and it became a model?
The Samaritan very much started like that. I just sat down to design a knife that I wanted to use that looked, you know, I had the features that I was looking for in a knife. That then morphed into that was the Blackthorn as a fixed blade, became the Samaritan as a folder. Then most of, you know, one design kind of warps and morphs into another one. If you notice many of my models, you'll have different blade shapes, but you'll notice two or three of them have the same frame. You know, for example, the Bill the Butcher has the same frame for a while that the Spade did. And I designed a different frame that was a little bit different. But the Rook and the Rogue, as an example, they have the Omega. The Rook and the Rogue and the Omega have the exact same frame and it's all different blade shapes. So I find something that works, the mechanics of it work, and I can chop, change, shorten blades, put a new blade shape into it, and it's constantly morphing down the trail of creation, really. You know, I'm evolving what I'm making, and along the way, that drops off different models. You know, the Samaritan became the Butcher after I ground the front of it off and chopped the tail off, and then went, well, that looks cool. And then I started making it like that. And then, the griffin is the yin and yang to the butcher. If you had a griffin and you had the butcher, the two of them fit together nose to nose. You know, so I go in and cut one out for the butcher, and then the other shape is already cut to be the griffin. So it's looking in the negative space of the material you're working with. Oftentimes, you know, I'll go in, and sometimes I'll work with great big pieces of sheet steel. And my designs now, over all these years of doing it, I have transferred into CAD, but most of it was all scanning and outlining and tracing what I had already hand drawn. So very rarely do I go into Fusion or AutoCAD and draw something from scratch. I've done it several times, and some of them I haven't even made yet, but most of the time, like I was telling you, it's a three-dimensional real-world process that then I have to reverse engineer for myself to get it into CAD.
You did a very interesting collaboration knife called the Unagi, which sounds absolutely delicious. Tell me about that project, and I mean, the name is funny too, but tell me about the project, who was involved, and how that came about.
So that was a project for Mission Workshop. One of my EDC knives, like this is what I carry, and it is an Unagi. Workshop.
Hold that a little closer to your camera.
Okay, here we go. So it's upside down. There you go. It's a simple design. So from start to finish, I guess quickly the synopsis. Mission Workshop is a gear company, much like Tad Gear is, down in San Francisco in the Mission District. They were exploring at the time. They do a lot of high-end backpacks and men's outer gear and coats and whatnot. And their design ethos and aesthetic is kind of clean, minimalist, modern, you know, black, grays, that sort of stuff, kind of urban technical gear. And one of the owners reached out to me, and it turns out, unbeknownst to either of us at the time, when he went looking for a company or a custom knife maker to design a knife for him, I was very good friends with his sister who lived in town. And it turns out, you know, he's in San Francisco with a home up here. We're about 5 hours away. He's researching on the internet in San Francisco, trying to figure out what knife maker he's going to use. Comes across me, likes my designs, contacts me, and then goes, wait a minute. Are you the dude that's the friends with my sister? So we hit it off, of course, because of that. He came over to the shop, and he was very much gung-ho about, you're the dude I want to do this, and we want something that's kind of a gentleman's folder idea, but I'm going to let you run with it a little bit. We just want it to be super clean, overbuilt, small enough that people will carry it. In an environment like San Francisco, isn't going to be a short sword you pull out and freak everybody out on the metro, right? So that became the Unagi. And I wanted something that was kind of swooping and had a flow to it. Named it after my favorite sushi, of course. Chad Nichols is the one who built it for us.
So Chad Nichols, we think of for his Damascus steel, but he also has a whole other part of his outfit.
Yeah. So Chad and I have become good buddies over the years. He, of course, is well known for forging his Damascus, Nichols Damascus. But he also has a whole other side of the business, which is doing building knives, building this sort of thing. Frame titanium frame locks. He's got a couple projects in the works for me right now. One is going to be a fixed blade, great big fixed blade called the John Jay, which is a take on the John Rambo knife. The prototype sitting back here.
So this that is awesome.
So this is the John Jay. Far enough away you can see it. So it's, as you can see, a really big fixed blade, and this was just kind of for shits and giggles. Because we're both kids of the 80s, and you can't think of getting through that time period in our history in knife collecting without thinking about, of course, a Rambo knife. This one's beat to hell. But what he's making for me will be the traditional hollow titanium survival tube gig with this blade shape. And then I'll be doing the ones with the bolt-up handles. So that's in the works. But we're also currently, he's about 6 weeks out on another full production run of folders called the Mini Rogue. So the Rogue is this blade shape. So Chad DeVries, yeah. So the Rogue. So this started out with the idea of moving the opening hole into more of the center location of the knife for the spidey flicking thing, you know?
Right. Yeah.
And so this,
I'm sorry to interrupt you. That's a blade profile on one of your very popular customs. And it's cool to see that in a more, well, in a production format.
Yeah. So this is going to be shrunk down by 10%, which doesn't sound a lot, like a lot, but it really, it's going to go, this is what that does for me. So you go from this size knife to this size knife, which is the Unagi. So that's the difference in size, right? So this becomes kind of a more EDC friendly knife. So this knife is shortly to be released in the Unagi size envelope, with some kind of trick. It's going to be a bolster lock with kind of some trick saddled, G10 inlays and some cool stuff that we're working on. So I'm excited to have that coming up here shortly. So, but Chad's a blast to work with, and Les is buddy up the street, which I think you've interviewed, does the logos and stuff for me. So we hit it off. Knife makers are all kind of a fiercely independent and stubborn lot of bastards. And, you know, we all tend to get along.
Yeah. I mean, I've interviewed Les a couple of times and chatted with him at Blade Show a couple of times. And, over this last Blade Show, he's just such a cool guy. It just sounds like a great group of three awesome knife makers making some really great work together.
We have some great, hilarious conversations, and some cool stuff gets made as a result. So I think it's a win-win for everyone.
There is a shot in this video that Jim is rolling right now, I think, where you take the Unagi and pound it locked down into a tree with a rubber mallet, and then you stand on it like it's a cold steel video. And it's amazing how that little titanium frame lock holds all of your weight, and you do not look like a small person either. So
no, I mean, I'm 6'4", 230 pounds. So
yeah,
and that was actually a 2.5 or 3 pound metal sledge I hammered that thing into the tree with.
Damn.
And when I stood on it, I made a point of making sure that I was standing on the back edge, so that lock face still had to take all of my weight after being shoved into the tree. And don't worry, I did cut that tree down. I had a couple people that were thought I was harming that tree, but that tree was already marked for extermination.
Nice. I like the way you put that. That makes it seem really. It must have been a hell of a felling. So you have a Nordic heritage. I've assumed from your name and from what I've gathered over the years and looking at your Instagram. And I'm interested in how that informs your work, but also how it, has gotten you very into Nordic axes, et cetera.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So I am the first Riddbaum that is in 100% Swedish. Up until my dad married my mom, they were still doing arranged marriage sorts of things within Swedish communities here. So my family immigrated from Linköping, Sweden. I'm also married to a half Swede. Her family came from Värmland, and they still have the immigration documents when they came through Ellis Island as a family. Mm-hmm. So I grew up just knowing my dad was a stubborn Swede, and my grandmother refused to speak the language. I don't know how to speak Swedish, except for several curse words, but just because that was a generational thing. They immigrated in. They became Americans. This is what we're going to do. And I'm not even going to teach you how to speak Swedish anymore. My dad lost it. I was never taught it. But we very much held on to, the heritage of where our family and our ancestors came from, the Swedish Christmas decorations and our little wooden horses and clogs and fun stuff like that. But, I do not eat pickled fish. It sucks. I think people. We have it every Christmas, and it's awful. I will not be eating lutefisk. I think our people did that because the other option was to starve to death. So,
right.
being that, my family is Scandinavian, of course, you think Viking and whatnot, that part of the world is very steeped in their axes, right? And I don't know if it's bred into your genes or part of your DNA, but I have always been drawn to axes. And when I moved on to this property, I had a lot, you mentioned I fell a tree. We had lots of trees that had to be cut down and we'll say processed, right? Mm-hmm. So I started using axes, and then I'm like, well, what am I doing with a modern axe? I'm going to get an old one. And I started looking for old stuff. And then I got interested in, over the years, I have quite a few customers actually that are in Sweden, and they know that I'm Swedish. So, you know, they've found old things from barns and shipped them over, and I've restored them. And that rolling interest kind of became, in fact, really early on in this career, I was doing work for a doctor who is in a army hospital in the UAE. And he's like, hey, your name is really familiar. I don't suppose you're from Linköping, are you? And I said, no, but my family is. And it's just a small world. So yeah. he's met family that I haven't even met before. And so here you are in the knife gig. But yeah. So the knife thing, or the axe thing, is a legitimate just passion project that turned into something that obviously strikes a chord and resonates with people all over the place. The last one I just shipped went to Switzerland. You know, there. So these things are bouncing all over the world. They're, you know, well, here's an example. So this was.
Oh my God, that's so cool.
That's a hewing piece that was forged in the late 1700s in Finland, actually close to the border, what is now Sweden and Finland. It came over just absolutely crusted, beat to pieces. I stripped it with electrolysis. I have a guy that works with me up in Quebec, a guy named Emil Bornival, who is just a mad genius with hand scraped and fitted handle, so he rehangs all that stuff for me. So they bounce from someone who forged something a couple hundred years ago, and they've been kicking around in Sweden. They ship over here, then they go to Quebec, and then back to me, and then they go all over the world. So it's interesting.
When you were cutting down and using an axe a lot, and then you decided, what am I doing with this modern axe? What exactly was your thought behind getting an old axe? Was it that they used them so much, they must know what they're talking about? Or,
well, very, very well. Yeah, that, yes, very much so. And just I just hate living in a disposable era where you walk into Ace Hardware and, yeah, there's an axe and I can pay $50 for it, but it's made in China and the tempering and the heat treating is dog crap. And I'm going to leave it out in the rain. It's going to rust. And I don't care about it. And I'm certainly not going to give it to my kids as a Christmas gift, thinking that they're going to hold it in the family, you know, but something that somebody hand forged and made and literally poured blood, sweat, and tears into to make because their life depended on it. You know, there's just more soul in that, you know, and an inanimate object, I think, can hold a value and an intrinsic value, almost like it's got its own little soul. It certainly has importance to the people that have it. And when you have a tool that's that important to people, it's an important object. And I hate seeing stuff just get discarded to the waste bin of history when it could be picked up and with a little effort and know-how can be brought back to a state that oftentimes is better than it was before. Because, you know, for example, some of the old stuff that I've worked with is so heavily corroded and pitted after it's all stripped, stabilized, fixed, and rehung. It looks in a way that can never be repeated, and, you know, because it took 150 years to get it to look like that, just through its deconstruction and evolutionary process of breakdown.
The axe that you were just holding up is really interesting because it has a kind of an inelegant head. It's sort of a brutal looking piece, and I mean, my first thought was that looks like a battle axe, I'm sure it isn't. What did you say it was? The purpose of that? Is that left?
This is a hewing axe.
Hewing axe?
And I mean, that's also a common misconception. There's very few axes that were made as battle axes because what were Vikings? They were farmers, they were adventurers, they were explorers, they were good dudes chopping down trees and making boats. So you make a tool that's best served for what you use it mostly for. which is chopping down trees, bucking up wood, making firewood, keeping the family warm. And then if you do go to bolt war and you need to use it, you use what you have, which is your tool. So, you know, I don't know of, I don't know personally of any purposed forged battle axes sitting around in museums. I know that there's a lot that look like this. You know, you go watch Vikings and every axe looks like that. But this axe looks like this because it was purpose driven for the need of hewing a beam square. Another example of that from a guy who was the head of the Air Force Forge in Sweden from 1864, I think, to 1900. This dude's name was August Hedvall. He was known as the Giant. So if you're a dude in Sweden and the people call you a giant, you must have been pretty huge.
Yeah.
And so this is one of his pieces. And this is about average for the size of what he made. And it is a heavy piece. But that great big giant,
man,
bearded look, that is for hewing. Which way is my camera going here? Hewing beams, making square beams.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so it's got a short handle. This is all new stuff, but the axis still exists. So this is no newer than 1900.
Is this part of your personal collection, or is this going out to a client?
This one is in my personal collection. But I don't know. The cobbler wears no shoes, Bob.
Yeah, right. Exactly.
Everything's for sale. I have a big hole in my office wall here where I had a beautiful finished piece that was on a board, and it was, you know, gold gilt like this frame behind me, gold gilded frame, and it was hanging there, and I had hand hammered a little brass plaque for it, notating where it came from and how old it was, and it was sitting on my wall, and I had stuck it on my website, forgot about it, and it sold one Christmas, and it boxed up and shipped it out to a dude for his dad's Christmas gift. So, it might.
How much for that guitar on the wall?
Yeah, exactly. Right. It's all for sale.
I've had knife makers tell me, because I used to ask, do you carry your own knives? And I got this so much I stopped asking. But people are like, do you walk around with your paycheck in your pocket?
Yeah.
And I say, well, no, that's a good point.
Yeah.
Because it's not nothing to make one of these pieces. How long would you say? Let's say you're going to sit down. Not sit down. Let's say you're embarking on making a custom Bill the Butcher. You work primarily in titanium, steel, and bronze. And so how long does this process take for you?
I'll quote Pablo Picasso. He went to a restaurant, and the waitress noticed him for who he was and passed him a pen and a piece of paper and said, will you do me a quick drawing? He sketched out something, handed it to her, and asked to be paid for it. She was offended and said, well, how can you expect to be paid for that? That only took you a minute or two. And he said, ma'am, that took me over 40 years to learn how to do that. And if it could be done in a few minutes, you would have done it for yourself.
Yes.
So take that for what it will. I'm talking around that and answering your question, because I don't know that I've ever been able to answer that. And I get asked all the time. Every piece takes, some of them fight me and it will take a couple days, and other ones, like, you just feel the vibe and I lose track of time. And at the end of it, you know, a couple hours later, there's a knife in existence. But to answer your question, it currently takes 18 years to make a knife.
Right on. Okay. Yeah, I get that. That makes sense. That makes sense, because the amount of time it takes you now, you look at it, you average it across time, and yeah, it took a hell of a long time to get to the point where
it's a lot. It's like everything in life. Everything worth having is worth working for, right? And if something is worth doing, it's worth putting effort in to do it right, or to do it as well as you possibly can do, because why else would you do it if it wasn't worth doing? So, I don't know.
So what's in the offing for you and for Kingdom Armory in terms of, do you have new models coming up? I know you're working with Chad Nichols, and he's going to, he's working on some production things. What's in the future for Kingdom Armory?
I don't know. I'm kind of at an interesting crossroads now. I've been doing the custom game for so long. I wouldn't say I'm burned out on it, but I'm at a stage in my life where I want to just make what I want to make the way I want to make it and then offer it up. And if someone likes it, they can buy it. And if they don't, then that's cool too. You know, the working off of an order sheet, off of an order book. I did that for many, many years. You know, and for the first part of my career, things got out of control and the order book was 4 years long and I'm swinging off my back foot and disappointing customers who have to wait too long. And then, you know, there's economic driven aspects where your product now is in high demand and it's getting flipped and some dude flipping your knife on eBay is making 3 times what you are on it. And, you know, it's, you know how this goes, Bob. It's, and not that that should matter to anybody, but I think the dude making the item should probably be the one compensated the most for it. So I pumped the brakes when that happened and shifted gears and just started taking very restrictive, small amount of custom orders that I could work through in a year's worth of time. And that went on for quite a few years. And then this last year was pretty tough for us as a family. And, it just made me pause and think, like, you know, I'm doing what I love to do, but I'm also not getting any younger. I don't know if you noticed. My hair is not brown anymore. Yeah. So I don't know. I'm going to do probably more production stuff. I'm hoping the Spyderco stovepipe is proven already to be successful. And then they were talking about re-upping and doing another run as quickly as they can. And then working with Chad on varying degrees of productions or mid-techs that'll be coming down. And I'll still be doing customs, but it'll be kind of at a slower pace. There won't be as many out there. And I'm probably going to try and take the time to do some more trick things that I've been meaning to get to and haven't had the time because, you know, I keep spinning the hamster wheel. But I'd love to sit down and make a couple autos and some things that I had a passion for way back in the day. And, you know, just life is busy and then it slips away from you.
Well, from my perspective, it seems you've really earned that, right. As a knife maker and, artist, to be working on what you want to make. And then the people who have appreciated your work all along will come along because they're patrons of your work. They're fans of your work. It's like in the beginning, it seems you have to take those orders because you don't want, them to slip away. You got to take those orders and,
absolutely.
And, but then after the years you've put in, what a great position to find yourself in that you can just express yourself, make your work how you want to do it, experiment, try things you want to try, and there will always be people coming along.
I hope so. You know, in this gig, I got out of college with a marketing degree, and what I learned from having a marketing degree is I despise marketing. I didn't want to go out there and force somebody to buy something that they didn't even know they need yesterday, and it just left, the whole thing left a sour taste in my mouth, and I wanted to do what I wanted to do because it was therapeutic to me as a human. And I also didn't care about, you know, standing up and being the loudest guy at the knife shows with a magnanimous personality and, you know, yelling and screaming and being a rock star. I knew those guys, you know, and I've worked with them and I know that that's a tough gig for them. So I just kept my head down and literally kept my head down and just grounded out. And, you know, I didn't really concern myself with, like you said, the people that appreciate your work will come to you. If you build it, they will come, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know. I've never really seen a need to chase followers. Look what Jesus got done with 12.
Yeah. Well, Dave, thanks so much for coming on the Knife Junkie podcast. It was a real pleasure to meet you and talk about your knives and your work. Hey, it's my pleasure. Thank you for your time, sir.
Appreciate it. Take care.
All right. Take care.
Don't take dull for an answer. It's the Knife Junkie's favorite sign-off phrase, and now you can get that tagline on a variety of merchandise, like a t-shirt, sweatshirt, hoodie, long-sleeve tee, and more, even on coasters, tote bags, a coffee mug, water bottle, and stickers. Let everyone know that you're a Knife Junkie and that you don't take dull for an answer. Get yours at theknifejunkie.com/dull and shop for all of your Knife Junkie's merchandise at theknifejunkie.com/shop.
Thanks for listening to the Knife Junkie Podcast. If you enjoyed the show, please rate and review at reviewthepodcast.com. For show notes for today's episode, additional resources, and to listen to past episodes, visit our website, theknifejunkie.com. You can also watch our latest videos on YouTube at theknifejunkie.com/YouTube. Check out some great knife photos on theknifejunkie.com/Instagram and join our Facebook group at theknifejunkie.com/Facebook. And if you have a question or comment, email them to bob@theknifejunkie.com or call our 24/7 listener line at 724-466-4487 and you may hear your comment or question answered on an upcoming episode of the Knife Junkie Podcast.